Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCXXXI, Probus. Probus had a fairly long reign for this time in the history of the empire. Keeping the barbarians in check is one thing, seeing off usurpers is another, but just don't ask too much of the military. They don't like getting their hands dirty. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
When Tacitus died or was murdered in 276, his Praetorian prefect Annius Florianus was proclaimed emperor in his place. However, at the same time, one of the generals in the east, Marcus Aurelius Probus, was acclaimed by his troops. Very quickly, things fell apart. Florianus had the endorsement of the Senate, but he was murdered after 88 days by his own army, probably because they thought that Probus would be a better candidate to be emperor. Clifford Ando makes this rather nice remark in his book Imperial Rome, that his sole actions in his days as emperor were to march west, then east, and then die. So certainly, you know, as far as emperors of the 3rd century go, Florian was particularly short-lived.
88 days and yet minted coins.
Yeah, yeah.
You get moving on that like day one. You need to be on the coinage so the people know.
Exactly. And also because the mints aren't just in Rome at this period. Like there's mints throughout the provinces as well. Mm. So you can get things out much faster. There certainly aren't a lot of coins of him, but there are also inscriptions from the West as well.
Okay.
That shows that people got on things pretty quickly and thought he would be the person to stay. But also, like, emperors are kind of replaceable in art as well, so they probably didn't have to change his image that much. All the emperors of this period, you know, had the sort of, you know,
beard.
The close-cropped hair, beard. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very easy to change one to the other.
Yeah. Okay. So what do we know about Probus then?
Very little about what happens before he is emperor. Certainly he is one of these Danubian emperors, so part of this military corps. The late antique tradition gives him a birth year of about 232, so he's probably in his mid-40s, the time of acclamation. And he's from Sirmium in Pannonia, like Trajan Decius was as well. All we can say for certain is that he had a military career. The HA invents lots of letters of commendation from emperors about what a great soldier he was, etc. As I've said, you know, this is largely fictional. There's also the fact that he's, you know, a relation of Claudius Gothicus, one of the previous short-lived emperors. And the HA, as usual, lists all these references for the works that he's undertaken, going to consult libraries in Rome. I particularly like the fact that he consulted the Journal of Tertullus Gallicanus, which I think is a really great name. And then they all say, you know, nice things about Probus, but in the end, we don't really know. The HA also commits a major faux pas. So there's a general...
Just one,
yeah. This is particularly bad. Tenagino Probus, a general who fights in Africa and Egypt, and he mixes up their careers. And we know they're completely separate people.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Being a general, though, the army must have been much more confident with this choice rather than the 75-year-old Tacitus, I imagine.
Yes, and also the fact that they murdered Florian pretty quickly indicates that Probus had a very strong reputation. Zanara says that when he makes it to Turkey to take over the imperial army, he rounded up the soldiers who had murdered Aurelian and Tacitus, severely rebuked them, and had them executed. Zosimus has this great story about it happening at a dinner. So Probus invites them all to a banquet, you know, says, you know, you're going to dine with me, all is forgiven. Probus is watching from a balcony, looking at the banqueting hall. He gives a signal to his men, and then all the murderers of Aurelian and Tacitus are, you know, stabbed to death there as well. A great Game of Thrones-esque scene.
Sounds very voyeuristic kind of thing. That's the sort of thing that you'd think that Nero would do.
Yeah. It's got an element of sadistic pleasure there.
Mm.
But once again, you know, these murderers of Aurelian are still around.
They're still around. Yeah.
They keep on coming back. Eros gets fed to wild beasts under Tacitus.
Mm.
So how many of them could there be? I mean, you know, it indicates some of these confused stories. But maybe it was a massive conspiracy.
And I guess if you get to this point, you really want to make sure that they're all dead.
Yeah.
So, a massive cleansing at that point.
And Probus does last for 6 years, so...
That's long by this standard.
It is. It's even longer than Aurelian.
Yeah. Being a man of the military then, he must have a lot of unresolved work to do. The Empire seems to be under a lot of threat these days from the borders.
Exactly. And in a way, you know, he takes on the mantle of Aurelian. You know, he's here, there, and everywhere, marching from frontier to frontier very, very quickly. Even though he doesn't necessarily need to, you know, reclaim Roman territory, there are threats on the Rhine, the Danube, the East as well. Mm. So he is everywhere. And we do have some information about how quickly he moves. For example, he's acclaimed in the summer of 276. By 5th of May of 277, so less than a year later, he's in Sirmium in the Balkans. By this time, he has the title Gothicus, which suggests that he actually campaigned against the Black Sea Goths, like Tacitus had done.
Mm-hmm.
There's a theory that he then journeyed to Rome. And the reason for this is that the mint in Rome creates Adventus coins. And Adventus is the Latin term for the arrival ceremony. And the idea is they would only create these if he'd actually come to Rome and they were celebrating his arrival.
Yeah.
It's pretty flimsy evidence, but this is often all we have to go on in the middle decades of the third century.
It's interesting that, you know, the emperor actually turning up in Rome is such a big deal as well, that we're going to mint coins to celebrate it.
That is right. Yes, exactly. It's such a celebration. And it must have been quick, because by the beginning of September 277, he's at Lugdunum, modern-day Lyon in Gaul. And this is because of the need to campaign in the region, because the Franks and the Alemanni are raiding over the River Rhine into Roman territory. And there are quite a few sort of different subgroups here. There's a story in Zosimus, Book 1, Chapter 67, that he fought against a group called the Logiones, capturing their general Semnon and his son. He took the booty and the prisoners, so took the Roman booty that they captured and the Romans that they had enslaved, and then he set Semnon and his son free. My other favourite story about these campaigns is the grain miracle. So you might remember we had the rain miracle under Marcus Aurelius, which Rhiannon talked about there, that saved the army in the Marcomannic Wars. Well, Zosimus and Zonarus said there's a grain miracle when grain fell from the sky, which provided much necessary food to supply Probus's army.
Grain.
Grain, yes. It was raining and there was grain amongst the rain.
Okay. I don't think that's possible.
Well, maybe there was some kind of granary blown up nearby and, you know, the food. But, you know, also Cassius Dio doesn't he talk about silver falling from the sky, and he uses it to plate bronze coinage in the Severan period?
Could have been carried by a swallow.
Yeah, exactly. There's all these stories. So then, you know, success in Gaul. But by early 278, he's on the move again. You know, he's moving southeast of the Danube against the Vandals and the Burgundians. So you might remember the Vandals from Aurelian's reign. They've come down from Scandinavia and they're moving southwest. The Burgundians, so this is, you know, where we now get good red wine from, Burgundy, in France, which is where they eventually settled after the fall of Rome. At this point, the Burgundians are a Germanic tribe, possibly coming from the island of Bornholm in the Baltic Sea. And once again, they're migrating south and westwards, looking for new lands, for booty. And again, there's pressure on the Roman Empire.
Mm.
There's a great victory, according to Zosimus. Probus defeats them by getting them to angrily charge across a river. He taunts them, saying they're not going to be able to cross. They do. And this is quite interesting, is that the captured ones then join the Roman army. So they serve as auxiliaries in the Roman army.
Yeah.
And they appear later in his reign as well, where they help to crush a usurper.
I guess the smart victory part of that would have been charging across a river is very strenuous work.
Yes.
By the time you get over there, you're quite tired and easily cut down.
And wet and, you know, soggy and exhausted. Yes. It's very smart for the Romans just to stay on the bank and get the other people to go to do
all the hard work.
Exactly. There's this interesting anecdote in Eutropius that Probus wants to encourage wine cultivation throughout the empire. And he uses his soldiers to plant vineyards. So we're not quite sure where to place this in his life. Maybe at this point, you know, perhaps after the defeat of the Burgundians, that, you know, he's trying to restore agriculture in the region. There's also lots of stories of him being interested in infrastructure. For example, he does complete the walls of Rome that Aurelian started. Mm. And when he's murdered, so I'm skipping ahead a bit here, he's getting his troops to drain marshes around the city of Sirmium.
Okay.
So there's lots of stories of him, you know, pushing the troops further to do infrastructure.
But planting vineyards, it's good to know he's got a side hobby.
Chateau Probus.
Not just blood and grain.
Yes. Oh, and the Burgundians, you know, it's a famous wine region in the future.
So that's what's happening over in the West. But it's a big empire and he is but one emperor. How many directions is he pulled in at once by the sounds of it?
Well, there are some incidents in Asia Minor in Egypt, about 279 to 280. He doesn't go personally, which is interesting. We are told that he leaves this to his generals, probably because he feels that the Rhine and the Danube frontier are more important. Mm. And also perhaps is that, I'll get onto a moment, there are also some usurpations, so direct challenges to his rule, in about 280 as well, so they seem to be overlapping, and maybe the ones in Asia Minor and Egypt were less consequential.
Yeah.
The one in Asia Minor is really interesting. So Isauria, which is a mountainous region of southeastern Turkey, it's been long been known for like harboring pirates and also brigands as well. And because it's mountainous, it's not really good for like Roman troops, you know, to go through and pacify. Mm. And so there is this rebel leader called Lydius who raids together with his band of merry men regions throughout southern Turkey, Lycia and Pamphylia. So I was a bit flippant there about his band of merry men, but
his band of cutthroat, bloodthirsty acolytes.
I guess what I'm alluding to is that, you know, he's one of these Robin Hood-esque figures who is supposed to, you know, be helping out the little people when the state fails to.
Yeah.
And so brigandage in the Roman world is very much a reaction to, you know, famine, people being forced off their farms, you know, agricultural problems that forces people to take things into their own hands. And so the Roman army under Probus's general Terentius Marcianus pursues Lydius, who takes refuge in a mountainous city fortress called Kremna. Again, we're still in southeastern Turkey. Archaeologists have actually uncovered the siege works of Marcianus and his army when they're besieging Kremna. There's a massive mound about 25 meters high, 140 meters wide, that they used to put the ballistae on to fire artillery into Kremna. It's clear that it was a prolonged siege. You know, they've found also the boulders, the missiles that were to be put in the ballistae to be thrown across the wall. No naughty language like Octavian's siege of Perugia.
That was my next question.
Yes, yeah. Nothing found so far. We can live in expectation of further discoveries. And then Zosimus is quite interested in this as a tale of resistance against the Roman Empire. According to him, Lydius' downfall came about when he actually insulted his own siege maker when he missed a shot against the Romans. And because of this, the siege maker then defected to the Romans and then had Lydius shot through an aperture in the wall.
Wow, he's got good aim.
Yeah, he does. That's an interesting sort of side story, which shows that emperors can't solve all the problems. Mm. And, you know, there are these local leaders. You know, Lydius didn't want to be an emperor himself, but he was providing some sort of hope and leadership to the disaffected people of southern Asia Minor.
Mm.
Over in Egypt, there's a slightly different event. There's the invasion of the Blemmyes, and these are people from Lower Nubia who move north, and they actually capture the city of Coptus. And this is near Luxor, and it's quite an important city because when goods came from the east, trade from India particularly, they came through the port of Berenike on the Red Sea, and then they moved from there up to Coptus, and Coptus was like the main trading location.
Right.
They've recently found inscriptions from Berenike, which shows that there are operations continuing there in the reign of Probus. He is referenced there, but the capture of Coptus by the Blemmyes would have been a major blow to sort of the trade routes. We know that they were expelled by one of Probus's generals. So again, this is the sort of thing that he can delegate, whereas he can't sort of delegate, you know, an invasion on Rhine or the Danube.
Okay, you'd want to be careful who you're delegating this stuff to.
Well, exactly. They might be very successful and then turn out to be emperor themselves.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Did Probus have any intentions of going out east himself?
Well, there's an interesting story in the Historia Augusta that says the Persian king, who he calls Narses, but actually isn't Narses at this time, that's a bit later under the Tetrarchs, this is Bahram II, made overtures for peace, but Probus rejected those and started to prepare for war. But Bahram backed off when he heard of the successes in Egypt against the Blemmyes. Now, you may think this is just the HA making things up. However, Probus is given the title of Persicus, greatest conqueror of the Persians, only in papyri from Egypt. This could suggest that it's just an innocent mistake and it just happens to be a coincidence. On the other hand, there could have been preparations in Egypt for a war against the Persians, you know, particularly getting foodstuffs together. Quite often we know that orders were sent to Egypt to get food, get resources, produce clothing for troops.
Yeah.
And so because of that, they could have thought, oh, there's, you know, a Persian war. Oh, he's going to win. We'll give him, you know, Persicus.
Giving him the title in anticipation.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay.
Perhaps not so far-fetched there from the HA, but we know that Probus himself remained in the West. And part of this was because actually that he faces actually some quite serious usurpations there.
Okay. We've foreshadowed there's a few, and during this era, it seems that every emperor deals with usurpers in some fashion or another. And as always, I do need to say you're only a usurper until you win and you become emperor.
Quite right. Yeah, that is quite right. Yes.
So who do we have here who is unsuccessful?
So we have four of them. Actually, the HA has its own separate life of the four usurpers.
It's got a whole, like, book of usurpers, doesn't
That's right.
It? And so four of them are from this era.
Oh, yes, sorry, I should say there's actually two of them. There's the 30 pretenders under Gallienus.
Yeah.
And then there's another four from under Probus. So,
right.
Yeah, there's actually two separate books. The HA loves usurpers. It's
yeah.
really interested in why other people might want to become emperor. So we have four. So we have Proculus and Bonosus are our first two who appear to have ruled together. We know that they were based at Cologne in Germany, and if this is a legionary fortress, so it's an important place to have on your side if you are a usurper. There are a few coins for Proculus and Bonosus, but they could be modern forgeries, so the jury is out there. But the coins of this period are so bad anyway that they could be genuine and just, you know, they didn't really have much silver to mint things with.
Yeah.
So. Once again, the HA fills out the stories of this people. So Proculus is a tyrannical figure. He's sexually voracious. There's a letter from Proculus to his relative Marcianus in the Four Tyrants 12.7. And in this letter he says, I have taken 100 maidens from Sarmatia. Of these I mated with 10 in a single night. All of them, however, I made into women. So I was in my power in the space of 15 days. Presumably, he means that he makes them into, you know, proper Roman women in the sense that he grants them citizenship.
Oh, I completely did not see that.
Oh, okay. Actually, maybe. Oh.
I thought he knocked them up.
Actually, I think you're right. I think I was wrong.
You're so precious, Caelan.
I thought, yes.
This is lad talk. He's bragging.
Yes, I had a very generous interpretation. Oh, he made them Roman citizens.
No,
oh,
no.
Yeah. No, he's got them pregnant.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes, yeah, that's pretty awful.
Yeah.
Yes, that's even worse than I thought it was. Yes, so, yeah, these sort of stock tropes here of aggressive, sexually voracious man are coming out here. We know that both men appeared to have died, probably committed suicide, when Probus laid siege to Cologne, and that was the end of their usurpation.
Right.
But the HA provides lots of other speculative details.
Which we don't believe.
No, of course not. No.
Okay.
No,
right.
No.
It's not like he said, I got a letter of myself.
Yes.
And it says this.
Yes.
No, okay.
No.
All right. So that's Proculus and Bonosus.
Mm. And then there's a guy in Britain who is never given a name. And he only appears in the Greek tradition. So he's in Zosimus and Zonaras, but not in the Latin tradition. The HA invents this other usurper for his four usurpers called Firmus, who we don't think existed at all.
Mm.
So we think that's a mistake. But the British one is quite interesting. So Probus has a general called Victorinus. And on Victorinus's recommendation, Probus makes this unknown individual governor of Britain. The governor then rebels, and so Probus blames Victorinus and sends him to subdue the revolt, which he does successfully. The interesting point here is that Victorinus does so with the support of Burgundian and Vandal troops, who have been defeated by Probus, then press into service in the Roman army.
Mm.
So there's this very fine line between foreign enemy, Roman soldier, internal usurper.
Yeah. You know,
they're all being deployed in different ways against each other.
It's always been the fashion of, you know, if you conquer an enemy and take them into your army, you send them far away where they've got no stake in the fight or the territory that's going on in that area, and they're less likely to cause trouble. So that's what this could be.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And, you know, Britain is, you know, far off, you know, away from most things that are happening at this period. So, you know, to quote, you know, Sir Humphrey Appleby from Yes, Prime Minister, it's like the what the vehicle licensing center in Swansea is to the civil service.
So we've got no name for this person.
No.
Okay.
No. But he's defeated.
Yes.
And then we know there's someone called Julius Saturninus in Syria. So he's a Moor, apparently. And according to Zosimus, so Zosimus says in Book 166, Saturninus, a Moor, the most familiar friend of the emperor, and for that reason entrusted with the government of Syria, threw off his allegiance and rebelled against the emperor. When Probus learned this, he resolved to frustrate his designs, but he was anticipated by the soldiers in the east who destroyed Saturninus and all his associates.
Right, so he didn't need to deal with that one himself.
No, exactly, and it shows you're exactly right by saying, you know, if you're too good a general, the troops might want you, but also the troops might be loyal to the existing emperor. So Probus doesn't actually have to go east to sort out this problem.
So if he wasn't dealing with Saturninus, where was he then?
Well, we know from coins that he celebrates a triumph in Rome, and this appears to be a foreign triumph over what the HA calls the Germans, that's probably the Burgundians and the Vandals, and also the Blemmyes, who were suppressed in Egypt by one of his generals. The coins refer to this, but also there's an extravagant description in the HA, and I know you like a good HA description, Matt.
Yes, yes.
So this is chapter 19 of the life of Probus. So he gave in the circus a most magnificent wild beast hunt, at which all things were to be the spoils of the people. Now the manner of the spectacle was as follows. Great trees, torn up with the roots by the soldiers, were set up on a platform of beams of wide extent, on which earth was then thrown, and in this way the whole circus, planted to look like a forest, seemed, thanks to this new verdure, to be putting on forth leaves. Then through all the entrances were brought in 1,000 ostriches, 1,000 stags, and 1,000 wild boars, then deer, ibexes, wild sheep, and other grass-eating beasts, as many as could be reared or captured. The populace was let in, and each man seized what he wished.
What?
Well, apparently people took all the exotic animals they wanted, you know, presumably to kill and eat them, because that's what Romans did with exotic animals.
I've never heard of anything like that being done in the circus. It sounds really chaotic.
I sort of imagine it as like when the genie and Aladdin come in the Disney film Aladdin, you know, Prince Ali and all, everything's going there, all the exotic animals and everything like that.
Faye.
Yeah, yeah, but Romans loved exotic food, you know. You get the weirdest things, you know, then kill them and then eat them.
Mm.
Ostriches, wild boars, you know, they're delicacies.
Yeah, but you've got to do the hard work. The people were going into the floor of the circus.
Yes, yes.
Amongst all these trees.
Yes.
So one effort.
I know, but people are used to that in the ancient world, you know. There's no, you know, microwave ready meals or, you know, menu log delivery, you know.
I'm too spoiled by my modern conveniences.
They knew how to confront their dinner in their eyes.
Here's so, me yes. ordering an Ibex last night on Uber Eats.
Just yeah.
Not even thinking about what the person had to go through to get it for me. All right, so after he's had his triumph and his wild beast hunt, what does Probus do then?
Well, we know he sets out on a campaign in Illyricum. The HA said he's going off to Persia, but it's probably a campaign on the Danube because he's at Sirmium in Pannonia, which is his birthplace. And there he found the city, and I quote from Aurelius Victor, chapter 37, damaged by winter rains on account of its marshy soil. And so therefore he forces his soldiers to drain the city for him.
Mm.
And this apparently is just too much of an imposition, and they murder him. Eutropius even has this detail that he was locked up and murdered in an iron turret, of all things.
Wow.
So, yeah, they obviously tricked him to go in there and killed him. There are stories in the HA that he was not only pushing the soldiers too hard through these infrastructure projects, but also he thought that there would be no need for soldiers eventually, because he was such a successful general. And this isn't just the HA making it up. We find this in many sources. So I'll just quote from Eutropius, book 9, chapter 17. After he had gone through a great number of wars and had at last obtained peace, he observed, and this is quoting Probus, in a short time soldiers would not be wanted. He was a man of spirit, activity, and justice, equaling Aurelian in military glory and surpassing him in affability of manners.
Mm.
But, as I said, this no need of soldiers quotation appears time and time again in the literary sources. So it's obviously something that is attributed to him and, you know, really cheesed off the soldiers who then murdered him.
It sounds like a very naive standpoint. I mean, of course, the Romans are always going to need soldiers because from some direction, there's going to be a usurper or a barbarian. You're never going to reach a point now in Romans history, I don't think, where you're never going to need an army of some sort. I also find it interesting that he annoyed the army so much with infrastructure projects.
Yes.
That seems to be a function of modern armies as well, that you, in some ways, try to endear yourself to the locals by improving infrastructure as you're conquering.
And it was the same way in Rome throughout history.
Yeah.
You know, road building, etc. You know, so many of the military colonies were essentially, you know, constructed by the soldiers themselves. But there must have been something about Probus and, you know, the sort of projects he did, you know, like the vines and the drainage that didn't sit well with the soldiers.
I wonder if part of it as well is Sirmium, his birthplace.
That's right.
Is he showing preference? Is he showing at that place special treatment by imposing on the army to drain it and fix it up?
Yeah, I think...
Is that too much of an imposition on them?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, you know? It's like modern MP, like, rorting things.
And yeah. He's my pork barrel.
Yes, exactly.
It needs a bit of draining, yes. So maybe killed in an iron turret, which is a new one.
However, the Greek tradition preserves an entirely different version. In this case, his Praetorian prefect, Carus, revolts, and Probus sends an army against Carus. His troops defect to Carus, and Probus is killed by his own men.
That sounds a lot more conventional.
It does. It does. I like the iron turret. I like the drainage and iron turret. It's new and interesting. Probus is someone that often gets a lot less credit than Aurelian. You know, Aurelian united three parts of the empire and put it back together. And Probus didn't do that, but, you know, a six-year reign in the late 3rd century is pretty incredible, and he covered just as much territory as Aurelian. And so, you know, the HA actually gives him a positive write-up at the end. Compare him with someone like Trajan and Hadrian, for example.
Mm.
Aurelius Victor uses his murder by the soldiers as an opportunity to muse about the power of the army. And he says in chapter 37, "From this point on, the power of the military increased, and the right of appointing the emperor was snatched from the Senate up to our own times, though it is uncertain whether the Senate desired this through apathy or fear, or because of its hatred of civil conflicts." He's saying that by this time, you know, there's too many military emperors. The idea that the Senate can proclaim an emperor, as possibly happened under Tacitus, is completely gone by now. And indeed, we would not again have emperors from the ranks of the Senate until the 5th century AD. in the Western Empire. And even then, early on, there'd be short-lived usurpers. And there's a couple in the dying days of the Western Roman Empire as well. But for most of the time, the rulers are going to be from this Illyrian military elite.
That was Kaelin Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any readily available podcatching platform. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, or you can follow us on the Decaying Remains of Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I am Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.